Tonight we begin a new study of Sunday evening messages on an amazing book, the book of Daniel. So open your copies of the Bible to Daniel chapter 1. Daniel, an amazing book. Children like the stories of Daniel in the lion's den, handwriting on the wall, and others. So we're going to answer a few questions tonight, just by way of introduction, introducing Daniel. Okay, chapter 1. In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. And the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand with some of the articles of the house of God, which he carried into the land of Shinar, to the house of his God, and he brought the articles into the treasure house of his God. Who was Daniel? He was a real person, not, as some liberals say, a myth. I wish they'd stop saying that sort of stuff. They will say, well, there was no Daniel. He is simply a symbol or an allegory of Israel when they were in captivity in Babylon. Well, that's not what Jesus thought. Matthew 24:15, he referred to Daniel the prophet and encouraged us to read what he had written. Hebrews 11:32-33 alludes to Daniel and the others. It says, for example, great heroes that stopped the mouths of lions and quenched the fire. That's referring to two events in this book. Now, there was a contemporary prophet of Daniel that knew that he was a real man. His name was Ezekiel. He prophesied before and during the exile in Babylon. Chapter 14, verses 14 and 20, he listed Daniel together with Noah and Job as very righteous men, and we should imitate their righteousness. And then in Ezekiel 28:3, he considered Daniel a very wise man. And again, that's an example to us. He's saying, are you as wise as Daniel? Are we? So here are some verses that tell us he was a real man, a godly example. In fact, you may have heard this. To my knowledge, the only two outstanding characters in the Old Testament that are held up as examples, and nothing bad is ever said about them. Daniel would be one. Who would be the other one? Joseph, that's right. Now, of course, there are a lot of people just mentioned only once and nothing is said about them, but he is set forth as a good and godly example. He identifies himself as the author seven times, seven number of perfection. What else do we know? Well, he was a Jew from Judah. Though his name was Daniel, he was not from the tribe of Dan. And the name Daniel in Hebrew means God is judge or God is my judge. Go backwards like the Hebrews do. Start at the end, El, that's short for Elohim, with a Hebrew name or a term for God in general, sometimes shortened to El. And you find that at the end of a number of Hebrew names. And Dan means judge. So the little I in between that, Dan and El, is either sometimes inconsequential, or sometimes it means my. So it could mean God is my judge, or God is judge, or the judge. He was evidently a young man, perhaps a teenager like the other three Jews mentioned later in this chapter. And he lived to be at least 85. So maybe started off at 15. How do we know? Because you look at the chronology. He was there for 70 years of the exile, starting in chapter 1. So most of the stories are when he's young, but one of them is when he is old, and then the great visions he got was when he was much older. He was also a statesman, I don't want to say a professional prophet, although he did record prophecies. The Jews do not put the book of Daniel amongst the prophets. They either put it amongst the writings, like the Psalms, or amongst the historical books. But yet he did prophesy. His main occupation was a statesman. They saw that he was very wise, so they said, we want you in our government. Now, here's a great lesson we see from him. Though it was an ungodly society, God put him in that position to do good and to protect the Jews. We need godly people in all realms of society. There are Christians that say, no Christian should ever vote or hold high office. Daniel held high office. In fact, there's a Christian magazine that once a year gives an award to the Daniel of the Year, a Christian that's in government or in education that is very godly and is having some good influence, like Daniel. He was probably not married, because there's no mention of a wife or children, and he was very young. And look at verse 7, he and the others were made eunuchs. Now, you know what that meant, that something was done so that they were never able to procreate. And this was done to certain high officials in government, especially those that were, put it delicately, they were in charge of protecting the king's harem. But some of them were elevated to be high politicians and statesmen. And so that was probably done to Daniel, and so he was not married or being a father. Interesting that his name meant God is judge, but in effect he was like a judge. They consulted him for great wisdom. It was noticeable. A person that has wisdom today is noted for that. We should be men and women of wisdom, so that other people would notice it and might come to us for advice. The family's falling apart, the marriage is in ruins, and they say, what do you advise? Be like Daniel and be a wise man or woman. Here's something other interesting about his name. Over the centuries, as the Bible was translated into different languages, when it moved into the land of Scotland, Daniel became Donald, and the most common clan in Scotland is MacDonald, but it's still Donald, and I am descended from the MacDonalds. Kyle doesn't get me any free hamburgers, but you could call me Daniel Donald or McDaniel or MacDonald. But Donald, it would be an old Scottish way of saying Daniel. And then in chapter 1, verse 7, notice that though his Hebrew name was one thing, Nebuchadnezzar tried to Babylonianize the Jews. Taught them a different language, said you have to eat different foods and change your religion. And so he changed Daniel's name to Belteshazzar, chapter 1, verse 7. And that's interesting because, as we'll see later, one of the kings that Daniel had contact was named Belshazzar. Just very slight difference in the spelling, Belteshazzar and Belshazzar. He was considered one of the wise men, and you'll notice in several of these incidents, he was a rival to the so-called wise men in Babylon and then later in Persia that conquered the Babylonians. Just like any society, they're going to be the philosophers, the educators, and the advisors to the high-ranking officials. Now, in Persia, which conquered Babylon, they were specifically given a title, the Magi, or in Greek, the Magoi. And we find them showing up later. Someone tell me where they later showed up. Birth of Jesus. It says, wise men came from the east, and the Greek is literally the Magoi, the Magi. And so people wonder, well, where did they come from? Babylon? No, they came from Persia, because it would be like saying, the Yankees played against the Dodgers. And you'd say, well, the Yankees just doesn't mean up north. It means the Bronx Bombers. So when it says the Magi, the Jews would read that and say, well, they came from Persia. So they were so the Babylonians and the Persians had their wise men, and Daniel didn't get along with either one of them because he outshone them in true wisdom. Now let's also say something else about the Magi that came to see Jesus. They followed the star, you know, the Christmas story. It wasn't just the star, and it maybe wasn't just an angel or a vision. Since they came from Persia, and that's where Daniel had lived several centuries earlier and written prophecies about the coming of the Messiah, even to the very year, it's very likely, and I'm not the only one that teaches this, the Magi at the time of Jesus' birth had read the book of Daniel, maybe they had left a copy back there, and they said, we believe this prophecy. And then perhaps they even heard the prophecy in the book of Numbers about a star will rise in Judah, and they said there's going to be the Messiah, the Son of God, that Daniel predicted, and he gave the dates, But we don't know the exact date, and we're waiting for some sign to know exactly where. And God led them by that star at the right time to the right place. Have you all ever heard it put like that? That's what happened, in my opinion. Okay, let's briefly mention this history in the first couple of verses. And this is very specific in the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, who was not a good king. You remember, there were a few good kings like Josiah and Hezekiah. And this is talking about in Judah, the southern part. The northern part had already been conquered and dragged away to Assyria as slaves. And then there were three attacks by the Babylonians. This was the first one in 605 B.C. The Babylonians had conquered the Assyrians. And then they said, now we want to go after southern Israel. So they invade in 605. And then again in 597. And each time they're getting closer to the capital, Jerusalem. And finally, they conquered it, tore down the walls in 586. And that meant the end of southern Israel, the nation, the tribe of Judah. Now, in one of those, Daniel and the other three young men, as well as some of the Jews, were taken off to Babylon, and that's the setting. And then later, the downfall of Jerusalem. Jeremiah 25:11 also predicts that the Babylonians would conquer Israel, including Jerusalem, and specifically says that the Jews will be in exile and captivity for 70 years. That's interesting. Notice the specific dates. Later, as we shall see, Daniel was one of the few that remembered that. He evidently had a copy of Jeremiah's prophecy, and it says that by studying, he said, the time's up, just like those magi would say, the time is up, let's wait for some sign. And that right after the end of the book of Daniel, another pagan king named Cyrus granted the Jews to go back. So that's the general setting. They were the Babylonians, and they were conquered by the Medes and the Persians, and then Daniel predicted when others would conquer them. Now let's look at some general features about the book of Daniel. Some consider it the fourth of the major prophets. Okay, who? Someone name me the three major prophets. Isaiah, Jeremiah, and Ezekiel. And they're major, not so much in importance, but in size. They are enormous, and then followed by the 12 minor prophets. You put them all together, and it's still about the size of Assyria, of Isaiah. Now, as I said, sometimes people put Daniel amongst the major prophets. You'll notice it follows the book of Ezekiel. Other ones, like the Jews, said, no, it's history or the writings. Be that as it may, the outline of the book of Daniel is very easy. 12 chapters. And the first six chapters have to do with stories. And those are real stories. They're not myths. And you know what some of the stories are. The fiery furnace. The men went in. The men came out. Daniel in the lion's den. The vision of the enormous statue. And other such things. The handwriting on the wall. And so that's in the first six chapters. And what you find over and over again is, it's a battle of the gods, the true God and the false gods, but also Daniel and his three friends, at least in one story, against the kings. And sometimes the kings viciously opposed them. Other times they were somewhat friendly to them. Get them out of the lion's den. Get them out of the fire. Elevate them. And the kings would be first here at Nebuchadnezzar, but we also hear about Belshazzar and Darius, and then later there was Cyrus that let Jews go back to Israel. We're told also in the first chapter about other wise young men, and we'll look at them, Lord willing, in next week's study, that were thrown to the fiery furnace. And according to the book of Hebrews, these were examples for us of faith. They said, we'd rather die in the lion's den or die in the fire before we worship the pagan gods. So we should imitate them. Another interesting thing is that Daniel exalting the one true God, and then there's that story about Nebuchadnezzar, so proud, and God brought him down. That's going to be an interesting story, that for 7 years he was like a wild man, long hair, long nails, crawled on his all fours like an animal and ate grass. Lesson there is, the bigger they come, the harder they fall, and God can bring down anybody. Same thing happened with the handwriting on the wall with another king. and then with the lions. So you see, God protected Daniel and his people. So those are some of the stories in the first six chapters. Then chapter 7 to 12 is prophecy. Now, there are some prophecies in the first six chapters. That the dream about this huge statue, and it says, now that stands for this kingdom and this kingdom and this kingdom that's going to later rise. But by and large, it's events recorded. And then chapter 7 to 12, it's almost completely prophecies and visions. And then angels are mentioned coming and going. Anybody remember the name of the angel? Gabriel. But also Michael is mentioned. And so there are other angels behind the scenes as well as the evil angels. So there's spiritual warfare. Now, in these prophecies, as we'll see, much of it is in very symbolic terms. We call this apocalyptic. We've used that term when we looked at some of the minor prophets. In other words, in these visions, Daniel saw like this huge goat with one horn and these various horses and beasts. You find similar language in the book of Revelation. In fact, you really can't understand Revelation without the book of Daniel. You find such symbolic visions also in Ezekiel and in Zechariah. And I keep saying they're symbolic. Because though they are true, they are not to be saying, this is literally going to happen. If that's going to happen, I want to stick around and see this giant goat with one horn and these wild beasts that are attacking. No, this is symbolic apocalyptic language. And you see that also in the book of Revelation. And so he got these visions that look like that, and he's trying to put it in language inspired by the Holy Spirit so people would say, it's going to be like a goat. It's going to be like these beasts. It's going to be like this big statue. It's hard to understand the second half of Daniel, just like the middle chapters of Revelation. Very hard to understand, just like Peter said some things in Paul's letters are hard to understand. There are some things in the prophets. The apocalyptic prophecies are a lot harder to understand than those plain ones that say, this king is going to do that. That's a lot easier to understand than about this giant goat. You have to say, well, what did this mean to the people in their day? But also, as we will see when we get to those chapters, there's still much of it is a mystery. Some of those would be identified when the fulfillment happened, which is a warning to us about predicting certain things, saying, I know what's going to happen in the future. The angel specifically said to Daniel, seal it up until the end. In other words, stop guessing how this is going to happen. When it happens, you'll be able to say, now we know what was symbolized in those visions to Daniel and then later the apostle John. So what we find amongst those prophecies, chapter 7 to 12, is what would later happen with Babylon and these other nations and to Israel, some of which would happen very soon and other ones would happen later. Now, as we'll say when we get to that, some evangelicals say it's going to be with Greece and Rome and then throughout church history and then prophecies right before the second coming, which is predicted. Other ones will say it predicts certain things immediately with the decline and fall of Babylon and so forth. And then it kind of skips into the future and doesn't say much about what we would call church history. In any case, it does concentrate on the immediate things, the fall of Babylon and the Medes and the Persians, and then the Greeks taking over and then the Romans taking over. And then it talks about some things right before the end of history. The culmination would be what? The coming of the Jewish Messiah. The great event. Now, it does say something about his first coming in chapter 7, and then more about the second coming in chapter 9. And aren't you glad that God predicted the Messiah? Do a study on messianic prophecies in the Old Testament. First one in Genesis 3:15, several in the book of Isaiah, in Micah 5:2, Zechariah chapter 14, and several in the book of Daniel. The culmination of human history. Now let me point out something interesting. Turn to chapter 2, verse 4. Read it and comment on it. Then the Chaldeans, or another term for Babylonians, spoke to the king in Aramaic, O king, live forever. Tell your servants, and so forth. What does it mean about in Aramaic? Well, the scholars have the answer for this. The first chapter and the first few verses of chapter 2 were written in Hebrew. And then the next few chapters are in Aramaic, and then chapter 7, verse 28, it goes back to Hebrew. They're still debating, why is there this language change back and forth? Why Aramaic? Well, the Babylonians spoke Babylonian, and what scholars call Akkadian. They didn't use an alphabet per se. They used this kind of a pencil with a stamp on the end of it, and they could turn it this way and that way and use another, kind of like an old-fashioned typewriter. But then the Babylonians, like many other people, also spoke Aramaic. You say, well, what's Aramaic? It's one of the Semitic language. Now, you know what Semitic means. It includes the Jews, the Arabs, and others. Semites descended from one of the three sons of Noah, named Shem. So they were related, but also in their language. It's been said that if you pick up Aramaic, you'll be able to learn Hebrew and these other languages because they're very similar. It's just like if you learn Latin, you can very easily pick up Spanish and French. And someone recently said that, yes, she's learned French. And she says, now I'm going to tack on Spanish and then these other languages because they come from the same linguistic family. Aramaic was like that. This explains, for example, why people could travel from Israel to Babylon or other places, and if they knew Aramaic, they'd be able to converse with people there. Or if they knew just Hebrew, they can kind of change it around a little bit, and people could understand Aramaic. I remember when I did something like that once. I never learned Aramaic, but when I lived overseas, I took a trip around Europe on a motorcycle and went to Italy. And I remember I needed to ask someone at a store a certain question. How much does this cost? And I didn't know Italian, and he didn't know English. But I knew Spanish, and I knew Spanish was similar to Italian. So I held it up, and I asked him in Spanish with an Italian accent, and I did Italian gestures. I said, hey, signore, quanto questa nestum? And he looked at me, and he told me in a way that I could understand what he said. That's what they would do with Aramaic back then. It was kind of like what we call a lingua franca, one that is flexible and you can speak in different ways wherever you go. Now that leads to another couple of points. Is there any other places in the Bible where Aramaic is used? Yes, a good bit of Ezra, which is after the time of the exile, when Aramaic became increasingly popular in the Middle East. There's one sentence in Genesis, a little bit in Jeremiah, and then later Jewish writings after the time of the New Testament. Because by the time of the New Testament, in Israel, all the rabbis and priests would know Hebrew, but the common person usually spoke Aramaic. Before the time of the New Testament, the Old Testament being written almost entirely in Hebrew, except a little bit of Aramaic, by the time the Jews spoke Aramaic, and most of them didn't know Hebrew, how would they hear the Old Testament read to them in the synagogue? Some of the Jews not only translated the Old Testament into Greek, but that was for Jews living outside of Israel. But they paraphrased the Hebrew Bible into Aramaic. It's kind of a loose translation. It's like in English, you have the Living Bible and other ones, the Message, which are really just a paraphrase rather than a translation. But that's what they would read for the common people that didn't know Hebrew when they went to the synagogue. Now that raises the question, were there other words in the New Testament? Yes, Maranatha is a word that's in Aramaic. It means, O Lord, come, or come again, Lord. But here's an interesting question. Which language did Jesus speak? Most scholars say he spoke Aramaic because almost all the Jews in Israel did that. But yet, since he studied at the temple and in the synagogue, he probably also learned Hebrew. And yet, The Gospels are written in Greek, not in Aramaic and not in Hebrew. By the way, the Jehovah's Witnesses say they were written in Hebrew because they say the word is Jehovah, not Lord or whatever it is in Greek and so forth. But they're wrong. There are no manuscripts like that. But it's very likely Jesus not only knew Aramaic and Hebrew, but probably also in Greek. He was trilingual. And it's very interesting to see how these scriptures were translated to other languages. And so some say that originally parts of the New Testament were written in Hebrew or in Aramaic, but it's usually acknowledged it's just in Greek. I do have an unusual book in my library from about 200 years ago where the author said, no, it wasn't. The Bible, or at least the New Testament, wasn't written in Hebrew, wasn't written in Aramaic, wasn't written in Greek. It was written in Latin. The guy must have been Roman Catholic to suggest that, because nobody else has ever said that. So, Jesus almost certainly knew Aramaic, and probably also Hebrew and Greek. Now, here's one other thing about the language of the book of Daniel. We've got 12 chapters in our Protestant Bibles. The Protestant Bibles refer to the Hebrew manuscripts, and that section that's in Aramaic. The Catholic Bible, as you may know, adds a few books to the Old Testament. Anybody want to tell me what those books are called? Starts with an A. Apocrypha. And it varies how many there are, maybe as many as 12. The Apocrypha was written almost entirely in Greek, and that was in the Septuagint, not in the Hebrew Bible, not in the Aramaic either, of Daniel. But some of the Jews not only wrote those books, which the Jews didn't consider inspired, they also added a couple of chapters to the book of Daniel, but it's in Greek, and the Jews didn't accept it. The Protestants don't accept it, but the Catholics do. Did anybody know about that, about the Apocrypha and these extra chapters to the book of Daniel? So if you have a Catholic Bible, go look it up. It'll mention some unusual stories that were probably made up because they're not inspired. Now, I began at the beginning of the message tonight poking fun at the liberals that want to really attack the book of Daniel. In fact, they savage it probably more than any other book of the Bible. They'll answer to God for that. Half of the scholars that write on the book of Daniel are evangelicals. They believe it as it is. They don't want to tamper with it. They don't want to attack it or twist it. But the other half of the scholars are usually very liberal, and there's very little in between. They don't believe it. Why do they want to attack this? Well, there was a pagan that attacked early Christianity in the 3rd century or so. His name was Porphyry. And later, even the Catholics, Greek Orthodox, Protestants, they ignored that. But gradually, theological liberalism started coming in, mainly from Germany. And these were people that did not believe in miracles. They didn't believe the Bible was inspired. They didn't believe in the deity of Christ. And so when they looked at the book of Daniel, they said, no, there wasn't a Daniel. And this wasn't written before the events that he predicted. I see one person shaking it. You don't believe that, do you? No. Do like this, not like this. Why do they attack the book of Daniel? Because they know it so clearly predicted certain things like the rise and fall of these various empires. And they don't believe in prophecy. They don't believe that we can or God can know the future. And so they want to attack it. So what they came up with is they said there probably wasn't a Daniel, but this stands for Israel at large and exile. And it was written after the events that it supposedly predicted. That's cheating. Because they're saying, well, Daniel didn't predict these. After these empires, like the Greeks and the Romans and the Medes and Persians, rose and fell, some Jew that meant well wrote a book after the fact, predicting what had already happened, and he tried to say this was the work of God through a prophet. And so the liberals poke fun at that. That is dangerous. You wish that they would not call themselves Christians and they'd leave well enough alone. If it's not broke, don't fix it. But they go after that. Prophecy after the event, and they say it's myths and so forth. So they say that the book of Daniel was written sometime much later, like 175 to 164 BC or even later than that. And you'd say, but it says he's written by Daniel and he identifies himself. They not only put the book of Daniel in the Apocrypha, they put it in a category of Jewish literature called pseudepigrapha. Hands up, anybody ever heard that term? You don't hear it very much. The Apocrypha was, those books were written after the Old Testament, before the New, and a lot of it is simply history and books of proverbs and practical wisdom. Most of it is just okay. It does have some historical errors. The Jews didn't accept it. The Catholics do. Protestants don't accept it. But it's not what you'd call dangerous. They don't claim to be inspired. But there's this other category of dozens of books that are not as good as the Apocrypha. They're not inspired. They're dangerous. They have all sorts of strange things. And they're called the pseudepigrapha. Pseudo means false. Pigraphic means writings. These are writings during that time period after the Old and before the New, and even after the time of the New Testament, utter frauds. They claim to be written by Elijah. There's the apocalypse of Elijah. There's the apocalypse of Adam and Eve and the Book of the Bee and other such things that are, they're no more inspired than the Book of Mormon. The Jews laughed at them. Scholars today love them. And so the liberals will say Daniel was another book of the pseudepigrapha, that this anonymous Jew put the name of Daniel on it, because if he had put his name on it, nobody would read it and believe it. So they said, well, let me put the name. That's forgery. That's a fraud. And so I repeat my accusation. This is pseudo-scholarship. And yet you look at the books, they quote many different languages, and it has the appearance of true scholarship. However, their pseudo-scholarship has been amply answered by evangelical Bible-believing scholars that every bit as scholarly as the liberals, but I'll give you a secret. The evangelicals interact with the liberals and they disprove them. What do the liberals do with the evangelical scholars? They either ignore them or they just kind of throw a bone like, well, there's a few over there that take this old-fashioned, out-of-date view. But by and large, they simply ignore them. Now, we see that when we try to answer their objections. They kind of look down upon us like we're not worthy of being refuted. But we can answer them with true biblical answers. Okay, lastly, let's mention what are the major themes of the book of Daniel. The main one goes back to the name of Daniel. God is judge. God is sovereign over the Babylonians. He's sovereign over the Medes, Persian. He's sovereign over the Greeks, the Romans, and all these other empires to come. God is sovereign over those false kings and the false wise men. God rules forever and ever. And that's the great lesson that those kings had to learn the hard way, such as Nebuchadnezzar, when God brought him down. What did he say when his senses came back? The Lord is God, and I'm not going to attack him anymore. And he said, everybody should worship that God. God is judge, and he is sovereign. That's the leading theme. Secondly, akin to that is that God raises up and brings down kings and empires as he pleases. And that happened in the life of Daniel. You remember the Assyrians rose, they were conquered. God brought them down. The Babylonians, God lifted up, brought down. He lifted up the Medes and Persians, brought them down. The prediction of the rise and fall of the Greeks and the Romans. This is alluded to in the New Testament, even in Luke chapter 1. God raises up and brings down whomever he pleases. Is there an application for us? What did I preach on this morning? God has raised up America. God could bring America crumbling down. God is above this. He cannot be brought down. And that leads us to the third theme, God rules in history in two main ways. And we see that exemplified in the book of Daniel, not only in his life, but in the prophecies. God rules in history, number one, through providence, his usual way of ruling the universe, the laws of science and the daily progress of what people do. But the second way is special providence called miracles. So we see some events in the book of Daniel are general providence, other ones specifically miracles. The deliverance from the fiery furnace, that wasn't a normal event, that was a supernatural miracle. Delivery from the lions as well. So we see that God rules, but he not only raises up and brings down his enemies, he rules in history, And that's our next lesson. He protected his people. He protected Daniel in Babylon for all those years, and then also in the Medes and Persians. He protected the three young men. What he's saying to the Jews that read the book of Daniel, he's going to protect you too. God delivered Daniel from the lion's den. What he's saying is, I'm going to deliver my people from the Babylonians and the Medes and Persians. That lesson applies to us today. We are Christians. By the way, this was remembered by some of the Christians who were thrown to the lions. They often took a very bold step. You ought to read the accounts of the early martyrs. They were like Daniel's three friends that said, God is able to deliver us from the fire. But even if he doesn't deliver us, we're not going to worship you or your God. Bring on the fire. Bring on the lions. And a lot of the Christians said, God can deliver us. He stopped the lions back then. But even if he doesn't, if he chooses to let us be martyrs, we're still going to worship him and not your pagan gods. So you see how that gives us encouragement when we face persecution. Next lesson is that Daniel and these others live godly lives even in a pagan surrounding. We'll see that in the next chapter where they were tried to be persuaded to learn a different language, different foods, different religion, but they stood their ground. We too can live in a pagan world and in an increasingly pagan America. By the way, there's an interesting point about learning the different language. We're going to mention this next week. Daniel did learn that other language. We need to understand the language of our culture. And not just the words and the slang, but know which way the wind is blowing and what are they saying and how we can answer from God's word. So Daniel and the others were only in exile temporarily. We're in this life only temporarily. We're pilgrims passing through, and God will deliver us. Next theme, God knows the future. You've all heard of this blatant blasphemous heresy called open theism. When blasphemy it is, it says God does not know the future because it's not definite, it is open. That is blasphemy. God knows the future. How do we know? Not only does he say so, but two other things. He has predestined all things. And next, he tells us the future in the book of Daniel and these other prophets, Old and New Testament. God just doesn't guess about the future. His prophecies always come to pass. So there's our lesson here. God knows the future because he has predestined it and frequently has accurately predicted it. Pagan religions can't do that, and their false gods can't predict the future either. Next lesson, theme in the book of Daniel, is God predicted and promised the first and second coming of Jesus, the Messiah. And those will be exciting verses we'll look at. Not just predicting the rise and fall of various empires, but the fall of the world system, Mystery Babylon, and the rise of a kingdom that will never fall, the kingdom of God's Messiah. So there is this promise to the Jews, not just of Daniel, but like Jesus said, a greater than Solomon is here. So like Daniel is saying, a greater than Daniel will one day arise. And then lastly, the major theme of Daniel is, this is the book that glorifies God and encourages God's people. It encouraged the Jews in exile. It's an encouragement to us here today. And that's our introduction to the book of Daniel. Since these studies are a little bit informal, does anybody have any questions by way of introduction to Daniel? He well could have. Good point. Yeah, Polly Danforth, Bible scholar, just like your mother. I forgot to mention this, that Jeremiah and Ezekiel were older, and they prophesied the fall into the hands of Babylon, and then they lived through some of that time. It's very possible that Daniel, when he was a boy back there, sat at the feet and heard Jeremiah and Ezekiel. Good point. Do you think he did? Very, very possible, yeah. Good point. Anyone else? Over here.
When you mentioned about knowing the language and knowing the times, It brings my mind, there were some people that knew the times. Do you know where I'm going with that?
Yep. The men of Issachar were wise who knew the times and what God's people should do. You know where that's found?
No.
No, somewhere it is written. In the book of somewhere, chapter somewhere. It's there, but I can't remember where. I think it's in Chronicles. There were men and women that knew the times. In fact, someone, David Noble, wrote a book called Understanding the Times. It says we should understand the times, like Daniel and the Issacharians. Anyone else? Now, as we go through Daniel chapter by chapter, the chapters tend to be very long, so I will not open each study by reading the whole passage. I encourage you to read it in advance. There's your homework assignment, class. And then we will explain it and bring out of them those chapters, lessons for us to live by. Let's pray and then we'll sing. Father, thank you for Daniel and the book of Daniel. You inspired it, it's inerrant, and it glorifies you as the king and the judge over all the nations, all the kings, all your enemies. You're also the king of love over your people, and you will protect us. Thank you for the first coming of Jesus, and we thank you for the predicted, promised second coming of Jesus. In his name we pray. Amen.